Coming back to the poem from the second night here, to the end of the first full day, that poem called Gift, A Day So Happy. And there was the beginning of the poem then, after the title, which is the first taste of hummingbirds stopping over honeysuckle flowers. So the stopping, I like also already that it's a stopping. It's not a stop, it's a stopping. And it's a hummingbird stopping. So there's such a speed. Because the creature is so delicate, that such a speed can be a stopping. And that kind of combination of speed and stopping would be interested in honeysuckle. That's also the food of that creature. But honeysuckle, not sort of, let's find, because then the other poem is the rarest wildflowers is the metaphor, which is also good in that context. But here it's sort of the hummingbird and honeysuckle. And then the question about what is this? What could we call this body-mind thing? Isn't there a word somewhere in some language that Laurie asked the other day? And feeling in our experience, so Laurie, I think you said like, you feel some moments of blending of body-mind. And I'd love if you feel like now or anyone, if not you, if you could put into words anything from that experience, how it is when there's the sense of blended body and mind. And so we can all feel while you also feel and in case words come. What's that?
Mindy.
Mind body. Oh, mindy. Okay.
But I find it gives it. Yeah. It gives it power because I felt very limited.
Yeah.
By keep calling it mind and body, it will remain separate.
Yeah.
And words have such power that I thought I'll just give it a little name just for me.
Yeah. Good. 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 Could you hear? And is there a way to put into words that what oneness feels like? So after that talk, I also thought, okay, it's true that there's not a word, but it can help to have, let's make up a word. So one word I thought is actually body. Because sometimes we'll say now, and it becomes common now to say, okay, let's be in the body. And what we mean, I think, is let's experience the body not dominated by the mind. Or let's experience the body not as something separate from the mind. Let's bring the mind into the body when we say body. So it doesn't have the resonance that your own word has for you. But it can be something we can play with of actually what's body? And depending on where we are, what's body? Does anyone else have any words for an experience of non-separation between body and mind?
And I felt my hip. Normally I would feel something here, but immediately my hip responded and something happened, like a pinch. And I was like, wow, it's not here. So the mind also can be in different places, and we can, and the body responds to the mind and vice versa.
Could you hear? Not so much? Shall I try, or can you try? Okay. So Ines was experiencing that the mind wasn't just up here, but down or everywhere?
Well, it's everywhere. And I had a thought, and it resonated directly on my body, not on my physical mind.
Yeah. So there was not the experience of mind being just up here, but also down. And then a thought came, which happened to be, I hate you. And in the same, with the thought, came a pinch kind of in the hip at the same time. And so it was an experience of the two together, the thought with the body movement, mind movement, body movement as happening together. So another word I thought we could play with as having a wide field between body and mindy, and that your own word could come. So also consciousness, which can mean so many different things, but what does it really mean other than body mind? It helps us open out what we think body is again. And also what we think mind is again. And so the hummingbird, that's the kind of the speed of the wings that's so fast, it looks like it's a shape that's like that big, rather than a little thing going back and forth, that fast. Sort of the speed of consciousness, that it's so quick and light that we can't quite catch it without a camera. As another aspect of the continuum experience, and going to that high end, so to speak, can help us include everything too. And then maybe a playful word comes for you, if it feels helpful to have with us like a kind of touchstone, that my usual ways of thinking of this is the body and this is the mind, or this is the mind and this is the body, or whatever. That we could have room for more of our actual experience. And as Khalil Gibran says in The Prophet, asking us, saying in the voice of the prophet in the story, how much that prophet would love to help us with our questions about joy and sorrow, ups and downs. But that what can someone do for us if we ourselves aren't ready to be not just peacemakers within ourselves, so not just peacemaker of mind and body, trying to find a way that they can stop fighting, but lovers of both. So someone had asked me today to speak more about mind-body, and that's now I've just asked you, rather. to keep feeling for what is the experience, what are the experiences, and what helps us stay true to our experience. Maybe a new name comes for now. Is there any other question or anything to share?
Maybe what I realized was that there are very, like, I would say easy or random experiences where I've had that body and mind was reacting on the same time. Just for example, when they have the explosions and I hear the explosion, I feel like this adrenaline going through. Mm-hmm. So I thought, but see, it's easily all around, so don't make a big deal out of it. Mm-hmm.
Good.
Because it's just...
Yeah, just honeysuckle flowers. Yeah, ordinary. Mm-hmm. Could you hear? Yeah? Cool, thank you. Freema?
Yesterday when I took a dip in the rice paddy.
So on the walk she slipped on that slippery part into the mud.
It was a kind of whole experience in that it was very fast. And my inner critics, which are usually pretty fast, were not fast enough to comment before there were just so many hands. Mm-hmm. And each hand knew exactly what to offer. And it was really, really beautiful. And it was, for me, it's a needing help is a big, big issue for me. Mm-hmm. And suddenly it just happened and it was there and it was easy. So it was big, just mm-hmm. as an experience. And some part of me would say it was clumsy, but another part of me kind of saw it as a dance. You know, a foot went in, hands came out, water came, another pair of shoes came. All these things were just scripted. It seemed like they were all scripted. And mm-hmm. My foot was just playing its part in this mm-hmm. whole experience that somebody planned for me, for us. So that for me was an experience that I didn't have a word for other than one experience, something like that. Mm-hmm. And I should say something that if I'd been standing in another place in the line and someone else rice paddy, I would have been in my mind thinking, you're being held up again, it's almost dinner time.
You don't know.
I know that's
well, that might be a program, but then in this case, the program that could have come didn't have a chance, so maybe.
Yeah, but I, what, the reason
maybe
I
your water bottle would have just gone to.
The reason I'm saying it is because probably somebody else in the line had that thought. Mm-hmm. And it's my story isn't one where everybody's in a good mood all the time.
Right.
So it was just another piece of that whole experience. Mm. Mm. It would have been and the other thing was I've never been in a rice paddy before, and it's really thick mud and it really pulls down your foot. So it really felt like maybe I'd never get out of it for a moment. And but at the same time, there was something really beautiful about it. Maybe I'm
in the rice shooting and it's pulling me back home. Cool. Surprising. A day so happy. I fell into the mud. Was there anyone else? Yes.
So today, I feel like having part of my mind has been really wanted to carry on doing the metta practice, which is so nice.
Mm.
And the storyteller mind is just like not stopping for anything. And then I've got to being, okay, the storytelling mind is here, so that's obviously, I should just be with that. And I was there with it, and it was just going, and then I thought, I expected that I would be able to see its root going down, and there would be some kind of unpleasant experience there from which it was making an escape. But when I followed it down, it wasn't that. The more I went there, I thought I'd be getting sadder and having releasing emotions and things, but I just felt really happy, and I saw this big happy face there, and I just thought, there's something good here in this. And then so in the afternoon I just let him take me on a ride, and we had such a good time. Today, then later we came for the meditation, and I really just wanted to go into the body or what, be in the now, and he was just like, we're going flying, we're gonna see Krishna, we're gonna go to the mountain, we're gonna make, it's just like anything I can do. And I sort of made friends with him now, because in the afternoon, one, I let him just go wild, and then there would be moments of just go quiet, and then I'll just see something, or I'd just be peaceful. And I felt so much more power and life in him than in the part of me, which I'm also making friends with, that wants to control and stop him.
Mm-hmm.
He's a really good doorway into a good feeling place for me.
Mm.
So that, then your voice came in the meditation to me. What about now? Can he bring you to now? And he said, oh, well, I can't tell you about it. And then it was just like, let's have a look at it together. And then we were both there, and we were like, wow, this is so amazing, it's beautiful. And he was like, there isn't words for it. And it was like this, where did this come from? What is it? And it was this for a time, and then and I wanted him, and I'm like, come on, let's go into my big toe. And he's like, no. And I'm like, well, I want to. And he's like, I don't, big toe schmo, he was like. And he's like, I can explode into a planets and universes, so. And then later, walking, I said to him, somehow you have to, like, we have to explore this body. There's a big resistance in him doing that, because if the stories aren't going to happen, like, it's not going to become a real thing, unless, like, it's like, that's a part of him as well, that we have to somehow do. And now he's a bit like, I'm not sure about going in here, but he was here now, so that's how it, I was having a mind-body thing today as well.
Beautiful. So I love all the So the honesty and that finding a real way with what actually is going on and feeling where the aliveness is and not giving up that it goes one-sided over here or over here or... And especially, I love how what you've described can help us know that really each one of us has discovery to make, an ongoing discovery. So it's clear this is so original what's happening with David. That it's, there's maybe, but there's not so much temptation, I think, that we should try to copy that in terms of the form. Like, oh, I should go find the storyteller, and while I want to do metta, the storyteller will come, and I'll find the root, and it'll be a happy face, and then we'll go for some rides, and then we'll say, where's the now? And then, like, we can feel the authenticity in that emerging way, and we can resonate with the authenticity and let our own real way start trickling up. There are so many techniques, and especially nowadays, so many techniques that are with different nice names and trademarks. And one thing that I really like about some of the so-called as if there could be new techniques that are coming up now. And I'm saying so-called new because in a way it's a discovery, but it's a discovery of sort of common material. So it's sometimes a little bit like when the United States somewhere, some business person tries to make a trademark or copyright or whatever on Indian turmeric or something. So it's new and not new. It's new to want a trademark. And these new techniques can be helpful reminders, but what seems to be a common thread in a lot of new techniques now is that people are noticing what happens naturally in a human process. And then they're saying, oh, this is a good technique. So just only a few weeks ago, it was funny that Odelia read that poem about the flight delay, because I travel quite a lot and often with my kids, but for the first time I was traveling with both children alone, just me. And we did manage to get to the gate on time, even though the queue at passport control was so long and slow. We just made it, almost the last ones on. And then there was some delay, so we had to get a second piece of chewing gum because we were about to take off, and then another delay. But don't get off the plane, because any second we're going to be able to take off. And then it was canceled. And then that same scene played out 3 times in the next 48 hours, which meant there was not that Palestinian woman with the potted plant in her bag and the nice cookies. But there was a woman who was very friendly with the kids and then very enthusiastic about her husband's work. And she said, have you heard of brain spotting? I was like, oh, God, not another one of these. Okay, an American guy from New York, right? Yes, okay. Brain spotting, okay. But she was so sweet. And then the second night that we were still stuck in the same city as opposed to with my children's grandparents for Christmas, we did accept the hotel voucher, and so we did end up having dinner with Mr. Brainspotting and his wife. And he seemed very sweet and even a bit shy, but even though his wife was explaining how many workshops with how many therapists he was doing in Amsterdam and Paris and so on. Sweetly, though, it sounds. He was most of the time on his phone at the table, And then there came the chance, maybe 2 minutes, that we actually had a conversation. And he very sweetly gently actually just gave Brain Spotting to me. He gave his registered trademark, personal business empire. He gave it to me. He said, "Do you meditate with eyes open or closed?" And I said, "Well, usually closed, unless there's a reason to open them." He said, "Well, it doesn't matter, open or closed. Just when, and when someone's in a meditative state, their eyes go somewhere. And they could just keep the eyes there. And then in that meditative state, with the eyes staying there, then it, there's healing." So that's Brain Spotting. There's healing. That's all. So, just like with Jinshin Jutsu, when we let our hands go where they'd like to be, or we notice that we often do that, or we often, it's that one finger that we're really interested in, that fingernail, we could keep it in our mouth, or we could hold the finger. That's all. So kind of recovering a natural process. And there are all these detailed aspects. So when we feel the mind everywhere, we can notice that the thought, "I hate you," goes with a pinching in the hip, in that particular hip, in that particular way, that then we also feel down into the ball of the foot or whatever. And so we could go with almost any part of our experience and just kind of let it stay, let the intelligence that's happening, the intelligence, the emerging, original, authentic path, let it have a little bit more time. Let the hand actually stay there on purpose. Or stay there, or stay there, or stay there. We can stay with the storyteller, we can stay with the pinching hip. And then I asked him, I said, "So that when the eyes go there, then that's not that wounded place. It's not a wounded place that we need to be." And he said, no, it's not. Even if it's the wound, when we're in the, and then I realized the real thing about Brain Spotting, just like every other thing that's helpful, is something happens naturally towards an emergent freedom. And in that meditative space, a space of feeling met, but not coerced, not forced, not trying to get free, just allowing, and there is an intelligence coming. Then it doesn't matter if the eyes are going there because there's a wound, because it's not going to be rewounding. It's going to let the wound heal itself. Does that make sense?
Can you say it again?
So what my question was, because he's a therapist rather than a meditation, it's not, in meditation, the eyes go somewhere and we can stay with that and it'll do its own thing and we don't need to know about it, we don't need to pay for it. But in therapy, the therapist is being paid to do something. And there's the danger if I'm doing something, then I might wound the wound, because we're focusing on the wound. You've come because you have a problem. So that was the one question I asked before then he had to go back on his phone. Was, so when the eyes, there's a meditative state and the eyes go somewhere, which apparently maybe is different for each person, and highlight certain circuits of the brain. So my question was, so where the eyes go is not the wounded place, it's not a wound place. And he said, "Well, it doesn't matter. It could be it might be at the wound place, but because we're in a meditative state, which in a therapeutic situation would be just being met without a direction, without a goal, trusting and allowing something else, another fragrance to come, then it could be that it's wound, or it could be that it's something else. It's." So we start to find that what really is important for practice is that kind of support that's not interference. And it's not so supportive that we don't feel ourselves. And that there's not a trying to get something that's not here. And we could really, this is where we need to be honest. We need to be honest when we do notice there is a trying to get something that's not here, which will happen. And to feel, is that really worth getting? Because then you might get it, just like with the cobra venom thing. You might practice to get stillness of mind, for example, or openness of the heart. And then you might get that, and it might be really good. Stillness of mind and openness of heart, good. Or we might be practicing to get oneness of body and mind feeling. And we find ways to practice that, and more often it is our experience, and it's good. But if I experience that as getting something, I'm in a shaky place. Deeply, I know if I got this, it's losable. And somewhere, it's like if I'm sitting and my knees are not quite supported, I feel like it's good enough. Let's just get on with the real thing, the real meditation. Don't bother about the posture. But the tension here is going to stop me from staying in stillness that long that I need to be immersed in that stillness because of the tension in the hip. So there's a tension in, even if it was really a discovery of stillness, it wasn't a getting, but thinking that I got it, and thinking that I got it through these means, these ways, this technique, then I'm holding and I'm using up energy that is needed in discovery. And so David's description of his organic practice movement or trail of the last day or so can help us each land in our own practice movement of today. And we can start to drop out of envy, comparing, which is partly a nervous trying to get oriented, or a nervous trying to be better, or a nervous trying to be worse. One time there was a journalist interviewing one of my teachers, or trying to interview him, expecting some, you know, philosophical answer, something like, not a hummingbird and not a honeysuckle. And so it was sort of a big question. What do you think is like the main problem facing the people of India today, or something like that? Or people today even could be, but we were in India. And who want to be free or whatever. And my teacher said, mostly that way of looking at what the neighbor has, that's the main problem. And that sort of was the end of the interview. the journalist was like, oh, never mind. This won't sell. And so I was considering this as one of the factors of supporting the natural unfolding of freeing. And as so often happens, I asked a book for have anything to say, and so I opened Krishnamurti. And as often happens, just very mind-blowing that exactly he was on the same subject today, talking about envy, a whole talk in Bombay years ago about envy. And how the mind with envy, so the mind that wants to accumulate. Do you know what envy is? Envy. Yeah. So, like, ready to have less, but hoping to have more. Like, assuming that probably there'll be less here and more there, and hoping to have more than you then. And by having more than you, I'll feel okay. That's the idea. And so then the question for Krishnamurti was, is it possible to live without envy? And he asks us to notice that probably, for most of us, we don't have the capacity to live without envy. And so our starting point is different. He says we could really notice what would be my motive for being free of envy. And he asks us again to be very ready to find that my motive to be free of envy would be to be a great person, to be a Buddha or Christ or whoever. And that if that's my starting point, even if my starting point is to be free of envy, rather than to find out what is it and is it possible to be free of it, if my starting point is to be free of it, then already sort of never mind, drop the interview. And so coming rather to humility, knowing that I don't know, but not humiliation where I can't know, I can't even ask, is how I would put it. He says humility, but for him, he had so much confidence that he doesn't know how it is for us normal human beings. That humility, we unhook it from sort of humiliation or giving up. Humility, basically as openness, as noticing that there is happiness in the garden sometimes and just a hummingbird and a honeysuckle. So, noticing that I don't know, and then from there. The mind that doesn't know, but is humble but not humiliated. He gives us a hint that if we would let ourselves be in that kind of truth that we don't know, that there's so much vitality. So another word that goes around these days a lot is vulnerability. And still, even that the famous Brené Brown, who is so good in talking about vulnerability, still sometimes she's like, me? Like, vulnerability? You know, I don't really do vulnerability. And her very famous TED talk now, it was an experiment in actually being vulnerable, talking about vulnerability for the first time in her life, and then it was sort of millions of views. And then businesses come to her and say, could you speak about all that stuff but leave out the vulnerability part? But in a way it's true, because it seems like it's gonna be vulnerable. But then when we actually enter in to knowing that we don't know, it's mostly that happy day, mostly. There's so much aliveness. And then in a way, we're just much less concerned about whether there's envy or not, and whether there's freedom from envy or not. It just something else starts to happen. that we could think of being like springtime, that, and we can't quite tell where springtime is coming from, inside or outside. And so the humility that then, or what we think is going to be vulnerability when we accept, okay, vulnerability, ends up being a kind of tenderness that has so much vitality. So we actually contact yes. That's not demanding to go somewhere. Just a yes. And that allows this ongoing emerging practice or path or discovery. So it's an ongoing discovery, which is what practice is. It's not that we're trying to always keep going somewhere, but it's an ongoing discovery. The way in springtime, like from the earth, that ongoing grass. And there's room for the kind of, it's so ordinary that we lose track of grass. It's unbelievable. There's a poem of Wendell Berry that he talks about starting, it starts with bleached, so like what used to have color has become white, the bleached barren pastures, so the places where he lets his sheep eat the grass are bleached white and barren, nothing growing there. And then just with the warmth and moisture that starts to happen in us, we can't tell where it's coming from. Moisture and warmth, exactly. Juiciness and a support that's not demanding or forcing, but trusting that vitality, though it's uncontrollable, trusting the vitality that something may come of it. So the yes with the humility, and then therefore no demand, no envy, and then therefore more humility, more vitality, more ongoing discovery. More chance to feel that fully met, like no matter what comes can be fully met. We're not sure, again, whether from in or out, fully met. And then we have the supports that we need. We have what are called the four gatekeepers of liberation in the Yog Vashisht. Then we're less preoccupied with whether there's an up or a down going on, which would then, if I'm preoccupied with am I up or am I down, I'm preoccupied with that in order to know how am I oriented according to everybody. I'm up, therefore happy. I'm down, therefore unhappy. That we forget about that. We forget about that kind of yoga. We forget about that kind of freedom that would be, because there's nothing bothering me today. Then I'm free. Because there's no limit on me, then I'm free. Khalil Gibran and the Prophet says, when you stop to speak of freedom as a goal, when you stop speaking of freedom as a goal, so then we can begin. So humility, no demand, vitality, ongoing discovery, where we also keep noticing a feeling of being met. So even when I notice that what's happening, when I feel the whole body, mind, there's a thought, I hate you. It's not like we would say, oh, good, usually, wonderful. And with that thought, a pinching in the hip. But because it's partly so unexpected and partly so real, there's a fully met instant, maybe before then, oh my God, or whatever story. There's a fully met feeling that we start to, our system starts to recognize as the main elephant, what's it, elephant? The main element. That we need, especially nowadays, the modern psyche. The word in the Sanskrit text is satsang, which nowadays has many different meanings. It usually means going somewhere and getting something from someone else who's better than you. Getting kind of high on someone else's liberation. Even if that person is saying, don't, it's in you, it's not in me, and I'm not that. But this being met feeling where when we get into it, we notice there's a quality of nurturing and a quality of spaciousness at the same time. A quality of nurturing and a quality of spaciousness. Nurturing and spaciousness. So Gibran says, you shall be free indeed when your days are not without a care, nor your nights without a want and a grief. So he's saying kind of double negative. He's saying, you'll be free when you do have a care, when you do have a problem. You'll be free when at night also there's something that limits and bothers you, maybe makes you sad or is a burden, a hard thing. So it's not about getting rid of those difficulties. But rather when these things girdle, so like wrap around your waist, these things, these difficulties, these limitations wrap around you like a belt, like a girdle. They wrap around, they girdle your life, and yet you rise above them naked and unbound. What is it but fragments of your own self you would discard that you would become free? So our usual way that if I can figure out what to keep and what to get rid of and kind of stay there, keep that position, that asana forever, then I'm done. Which would be not naked, but fully clothed, fully armored. So feeling where we're trying to get rid of something and how that is a part of myself. So like the storyteller that David mentioned. I'd like to share a poem by Denise Levertov. Some of you might have heard me say it before because I love it. It's called Beyond the Field. Light, flake by flake. Flake, like floquito maybe, like nieve. But in this case, light, flake by flake, touching down on surface tension of ocean, strolling, so that's like walking without a particular purpose, strolling there before diving forever under. So light, flake by flake, touching down on surface tension of ocean, strolling there before diving forever under. We can feel how this is our life, our experience, our mind, our perceptions, flake by flake, touching down, strolling, diving forever under. Tectonic plates, so of the earth, that underground, way underground, floating, so the earth actually, is apparently, supposedly, like a balloon full of mayonesa, in Catalan mayonesa, in Spanish, mayonesa, maybe, yeah. So if we have a balloon of mayonnaise, and that balloon part is a little bit crusty, a little bit firm, that's the earth. So we have so much solid earth, but then under that, there's way, way, way more that's all juicy. The bottom of the crust is floating on the mayonnaise in these plates that, of course, scrape and rush and rub and crumple, and so the earthquakes. So way, way, way down, in touch with the deep, abundant juiciness of ourselves and of life. Tectonic plates, inaudibly, we can't hear it, grinding, shifting, monumental fidgets. So a fidget would be kind of like that thing where you keep writing on your finger when you're doing Jinshin and you don't know it. Fidget, or maybe almost a tick. But monumental. So things are happening way down there, close to the juice, that do make a big difference up here. Not in our control. The mind's far edges twitch, sensing kinships beyond reach. So the far edges of the mind, yeah? The far edges of la mente, way, way over there, twitch. So they just move without my asking them to, slightly, suddenly. And in that movement, that's not me moving it, not me controlling it, not me even understanding it. In that movement, there is a sensing. Sensing kinship, so that's where, what would be that in Spanish, kinships? Connections that are like family, connections, really, that where we're met, there's a meeting. Is there anything like kinship in Spanish? Kin is similar, connected to the word knowing, canoeing. So a kind of knowing of our togetherness, our synchronicitous, mysterious, co-happening together. Non-separation. The mind's far edges twitch, sensing kinships beyond reach. So we can't actually get there, but we can sense that it's happening beyond what we think we are. Too much unseen, unknown, unknowable. Assumed missing, therefore. Shadings, clues, transitions, linking rivers of event, imaged, not imaged, a flood that rushes towards us, through us, away, beyond us, before we wheel to face what seems a trace of passage, ripple already stilling itself in tall grass near the fence of the mind's field. So she purposely has this long sentence that keeps not ending. Because there's too much unseen, unknown, unknowable, assumed, missing, therefore. And that's when we do start to notice that if I locate myself in the conscious thinking, then I'm experiencing things that I can't really have access to totally. And if I locate myself not only in the thinking, but in a body-mind to start with, or in a consciousness that has room for body-mind to be way more roomy than what we think of as body-mind, then things that are that far away and huge and important and powerful as the plates under all that we know of as earth, on top of the mayonnaise, in our own being, those movements, all that sort of flowing through us that keep being all, that everything is a sign of aliveness and intelligence. So where the eyes go when we meditate is a clue, is a shading. Some of it we kind of get or think we get, and way more of it, there's no way we can get. with our little butterfly net. And still something in us eventually does try to turn. It's not as fast as the hummingbird consciousness, but something in the mind tries to turn to face the flood of experience. But before we can turn to see what was just over here, all that's left is, she says, it's like a field of grass and a little wave going through the grass. That wave is already stopping. Just a clue of something bigger, wider. And as we let ourselves kind of settle and melt down into that way bigger, kind of fact or experience, we let things come in from the side, from the corner of the eye, from the below the bedrock, below the deepest part of the earth. We let that movement be felt. We don't have to always turn the viewfinder over and then we say, okay, that's true, that's real, that happened. We know that happened, that's happening. We do. And it's actual just simple animal skills that we can start to recover. As well as something more important. And so, in other words, we start to let ourselves be inside of ourselves as a much bigger organism or creature or place or space. And being inside, then, it's just like the experience of our own face. It looks very different from here than if from here. And what's actually more real? So when there's something on our nose or next to the eye, it looks big, huge, from here, from inside. And who's to say that our head isn't that big? All of that. And all of my teachers have taught this way, from the side, with that. Did he really just say that? In a half voice. The big moments of that are small moments of meeting was not when I was wheeling to face, but in a moment from the side. Something that, did he say that? He said that. Did he say that? Or it might be face to face, but the way of it being said is not addressing who I think I am. And so who I think I am is can you say that? No, you can't say that. That's not said. But it was said. And so we settle down and we melt down and we kind of undo ourselves down into what we are more and more. With and through the help of that meeting quality where there's nurturing and space. Which does have something to do with a kind of, we could call it source quality. It does have a feeling of where we come from, where we belong. And it does kind of rhyme with mothering quality. The problem is our actual mothers are real people. And so if we say mother, then it's also complicated and different, mostly. Being here with little Leela, who I forgot to mention the first night of the second retreat as being our real teacher here. And she also agrees because she said, Jaya and Adelia are talking, and I'm also talking, so I'm also a teacher. I'm one of the teachers here. Yes. The little girl. Yeah. Who's staying in one of our little huts. And she has been so mothered that mother is maybe not so complicated. And the quality of her receiving a hug in the morning, like the way she snuggles in, the way she receives nurturing and spaciousness, is such a teaching. And so getting close into that nurturing, spacious source of springtime quality. It's like in some of the songs of Mirabai, who was an Indian woman some centuries ago, who loved God, and sometimes she had some kind of conflict because she really loved, and she would see Krishna, actually, as David mentioned before. And she loved seeing him. It was so. She said, even the bells around your hips are so juicy. But then she's like, please come live inside my eyes. Because she was seeing him, she would play chess with him. But then, please come live inside my eyes. Or in another poem, she talks about in that that's so light and playful, like giving so much room for things to play, and yet that strong that it can lift a mountain, if needed, only. If needed, yeah, sure. Aliveness is that buoyant and supportive that a mountain can be lifted if needed. To be drenched in that. And so, just like the bleached fields, so the fields that are just so white, there's nothing growing there. And then springtime comes, and within a day, it's green. And room in us for that green, like we understand green photosynthesis, blah, 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 but still. Don't let that make us think we really know. Even if we know the mechanism, it's still really weird that there's green out of white and brown, moisture and warmth. I'd just like to end with a poem, this poem. The pasture, bleached and cold 2 weeks ago, begins to grow in the spring light and rain. The new grass trembles, so shakes slightly, under the wind's flow. The flock, so the group of sheep, barn weary, they've been inside all winter, comes to it again. New to the lambs, a place their mothers know. Welcoming, bright and savory, so yummy, has good flavor, not sweet, in its green, welcoming, bright, and savory in its green. So fully does the time recover it, nibbles of pleasure go all over it. That's the end of the poem, and it's a sweetly rhyming poem. The pasture, so the field where the sheep go, the pasture, bleached and cold 2 weeks ago, begins to grow in the spring light and rain. The new grass trembles under the wind's flow. The flock, barn weary, comes to it again. New to the lambs, a place their mothers know. Welcoming, bright, and savory in its green. So fully does the time recover it. Nibbles of pleasure go all over it. So the nibbling, as that is discovery of our, that is what practice is as discovery. where there's been something continually, there's a freshness, continually there's that new part that this is all new, and there's also that knowing. The mothers know it, the babies don't. And in us, the knowing and the newness, both. Both knowing and allowed to nibble. So nibble is little tiny bites. Thank you for listening and being here, being part of this ongoing flood of discovery. May our practice and lives be in peace, bright and savory, springing from we know not where, from everywhere, dedicated nibblingly to the momentum towards liberation for all, including ourselves.